advocated for more urgent issues such as developing a sustainable economy and the environment.
South Korea's arms production is at such a scale to be considered a military-industrial complex. Many of South Korea's largest corporations are heavily invested in the industry, which carries significant economic and political influence. South Korea also recently outlined development of a bunker-busting bomb to be deployed on a ballistic missile, following an agreement with the U.S. to eliminate limits on South Korea's missile payload and range. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Speakers of parliament from around the world gather in Vienna to focus on the most urgent matter of the day, the COVID pandemic.
Most participants concluded the world has not shown competency in dealing with the COVID pandemic, with unilateral policies blocking the vital multilateralism required for joint research and the fair distribution of vaccines.
Iran is among those hardest hit by the pandemic, and the country's visiting MPs say U.S. sanctions are hampering efforts to control the virus.
The unjust sanctions that the U.S. has imposed on Iran have made us unable to import medicines and medical supplies or to take action to remedy the current situation in the country. We need to create fair and equal conditions for all, even if it's solely for the sake of controlling the virus.
Cuba was another country that complained about U.S. sanctions.
The U.S. government has been tightening the embargo that is throttling us. Even food and medicines are being kept out, and vital medical supplies are withheld.
Azerbaijan criticized the fact that some countries are stocking up on far more vaccines than their actual needs, while poorer nations are left behind. In Yemen, said the country's representative, people live amidst war, poverty and hunger and need vaccines as well as international assistance. To produce one kind of vaccine, the conference was told, a manufacturing company needs ingredients from 19 different countries. No one country can do this alone. So why is the technology not being shared? All hopes lie with the vaccination campaign, but will economic incentives continue to override humanitarian ones? Homolesky, Vienna.
Weeks after the fall of Kabul to the Taliban and only a few days after the group's spokesman declared victory of Panjshir clash, the Taliban announced the lineup of its caretaker government.
Mohtaram Al-Haj Muhammad Hassan Akhund has been appointed as the acting prime minister. Mullah Abdul Ghani Baradar and Maulavi Abdul Salam Hanafi will serve as his deputies. Maulavi Muhammad Yaqub Mujahid and Al-Haj Mullah Sirajuddin Haqqani are also appointed as the acting defense and interior ministers. Maulavi Amir Khan Muttaqi serves as acting foreign minister of the caretaker government.
The declaration of the caretaker government of Taliban has sparked mixed reactions inside and abroad. Many have criticized the Taliban for not forming an inclusive government. They, for instance, argue that all members of the newly declared acting cabinet ministers are Taliban figures. Moreover, the absence of women in Taliban's caretaker government is considered as one of the other causes behind rising criticism among Afghans, especially women. In protest to the lineup of Taliban's caretaker government, Afghan women took to the streets of Kabul and voiced their anger at the absence of women in the newly declared cabinet ministers. Despite this, Taliban officials insist that they are fully committed to respect and even protect women's rights. They also said will declare an inclusive government that will remove all current public concerns and criticisms.
Our country is facing numerous challenges, mainly poverty. Furthermore, the country has just left behind a crisis. Now security is restored to all parts of the country. So we declared this caretaker government to manage the urgent in a better way. We will, of course, declare an inclusive government soon.
We want security and don't care who brings it to us. If they are right, the Taliban must help us go back to our village in northeastern Badakhshan. I also ask the Taliban to avoid any further violence in the country by establishing an inclusive government.
Besides local reactions to the declaration of Taliban's government, Some states, including China and Uzbekistan, have welcomed this recent move of Taliban in terms of declaring and acting cabinet ministers. Some other countries, however, insist that the only legitimate government in Afghanistan will be the one which must take power based on the will of the people of Afghanistan. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
The visit of Qatar's foreign minister is the latest in a series of visits undertaken by foreign dignitaries to Pakistan in recent days. Following the visits of foreign ministers of Germany, Italy, UK and Netherlands, the visit of Qatar's top diplomat also focused on Afghanistan. His visit comes just days after the Afghan Taliban announced an interim government that drew criticism from certain Western countries for ignoring the demands of inclusive setup. Speaking at a joint news conference, Pakistani Foreign Minister Shah Mahmood Qureshi said the immediate priority must be the well-being of the people of Afghanistan.
And the most important thing that we both agree to is that we have to protect the interests of the people of Afghanistan. And for that, their safety, their security, stability, and to ensure that this Afghanistan, you know, does not become an arena for, you know, for proxy wars.
Since the Taliban took over, there have been fears of economic meltdown as the international financial institutions and Western countries suspended the assistance.
Humanitarian situation and humanitarian assistance should be independent from any political progress, because we believe that the Afghan people deserve to be helped, deserve to be supported, despite what's happening in the political landscape.
The Qatari foreign minister said the inclusive government is important for the unity of Afghanistan. The interim government announced by the Taliban was contrary to the commitment they made earlier that the political dispensation would be inclusive and broad-based. The interim government is set to take oath on the 20th anniversary of 9/11 attacks in the United States. Many countries are closely watching the Taliban whether they live up to their promises. But Pakistan and Qatar maintain that the world community should not take any steps that may aggravate the problems for the people of Afghanistan. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
Palestinians organized several rallies in the Gaza Strip in solidarity with Palestinian detainees in Israeli jails, where tensions mounted as Israeli regime began to practice a brutal crackdown on Palestinian prisoners and transfer them to new facilities. Palestinian inmates set fire to cells protesting the Israeli violent measures against them that have doubled after six Palestinian inmates escaped Jalbu prison early this week.
Palestinian inmates in Israeli jails have been facing a war crime, especially after the heroic escape by six Palestinian inmates from Jalbu prison. Israel has adopted violent measures against Palestinian detainees, including solitary confinement.
Palestinian resistance factions called prisoners to resist these attempts to transfer them to various facilities, describing the condition in Israeli jails as war crime that requires urgent move to protect the Palestinian detainees. Palestinian Prisoners Club warned that tension would escalate between Palestinian detainees and the Israeli regime over the relocating of some detainees from the Islamic Jihad movement, as most of the six inmates are affiliated with the group.
The Palestinian resistance has a clear message that any Israeli attack threatening the lives of the prisoners will lead to serious consequences, and the Israeli regime will pay a heavy price for any violation. Our Palestinian resistance is ready to defend our detainees. Also, it's a national Palestinian duty to provide safety for the six heroes who have escaped the Israeli prison.
Palestinians called the international community and human rights groups to make serious actions in order to protect the Palestinian detainees from the Israeli violence.
We hope that all Palestinian detainees will be free soon. We are here to support our inmates
We won't remain silent amid the international community's apathy towards the issue. We will raise our voices against the international conventions that are only written on paper with no practical results.
Six Palestinian inmates escaped from the high-security Jilbu prison in northern parts of the occupied territories on Monday, prompting a massive manhunt by Israeli army.
Along with its manhunt for six Palestinian detainees, the Israeli army has practiced violent measures against detainees inside jails. Palestinians here say they can't remain silent as the prisoners' issue is among their top priorities. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
The British government has come under renewed condemnation after failing to honour their pledge to define Islamophobia 2 years after making the initial promise. With MPs and critics all condemning the lack of action amid rising Islamophobia across the UK, an all-party parliamentary group on British Muslims created their own definition of Islamophobia in 2018, describing it as a form of racism.
Islamophobia is rooted in racism and is a type of racism that targets expressions of Muslimness or perceived Muslimness.
Regardless which political group makes the definition, grassroots British Muslim groups are concerned over what they see as an establishment-pushed definition.
The best case scenario for this definition of Islamophobia would be one that forces the government to critically self-reflect and critically analyse its policies and policies of previous governments that have led to Islamophobia. I do specifically mean the so-called counter-extremism policies, which have just been a thinly veiled excuse to surveil the Muslim community. And these policies have had such detrimental impacts on the mental and physical well-being of the Muslim community. It's so likely we're going to have a watered-down definition that is nothing more than empty words. Why? Because there's been no engagement with the grassroots of society. There's been no engagement with organisations like ours, like MPAC UK, or CAGE, or MEND, or, critically, active massages like Lewisham Islamic Centre. There's been no engagement with organisations like these which have had to deal with the mess created by 20 years of suspicion and policies and institutionalised Islamophobia.
Some have already begun to adopt the definition, including the opposition Labour Party. However, accusations of Islamophobia within Labour remain, despite its implementation.
A lot of scepticism still surrounds this definition, with many fearing that it will ultimately fail to serve the community effectively, if at all. However, while MPs continue to procrastinate on the issue, Islamophobia remains a very real and persistent threat on both a street and systemic level. Robert Carter, London.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
The Supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it abundant praise. I seek refuge in him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among thy troops are the victors, and place me in thy party, for thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among thy friends, for thy friends no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging. And to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless thou forgives it, and leave no grief unless thou takes it away, and leave no enemy, and leave no enemy unless thou repelst him. By means of in the name of Allah, the best of the names, in the name of Allah, Lord of earth and heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is his anger. And I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is his good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from thee, O patron of beneficence.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. 20 years have passed since the terrorist attacks on 9/11 in the U.S., and some documents about the investigation of the incident have just been declassified. This after some families of the victims of 9/11 told U.S. President Joe Biden to declassify the documents or not to appear at commemoration ceremonies. Well, the highly redacted documents point to possible involvement by Saudi officials with at least two of the hijackers. What does this say about the Saudis, and what does it say about American officials who have ignored this information for so long? Well, I'd like to start this off with Wyatt Reed, correspondent in Washington. Tell us about what's being said about this Saudi connection.
That's right. We have a 16-page report that's been declassified here, not but new, coming out of this, at least of the portions that are simply unreadable, just large blocks of text that are totally blacked out for various reasons, chief among them being that other U.S. government agencies declined to allow those to be redacted. They said that would somehow jeopardize their operations. So a lot of connections still very unclear. This report focused mainly on two of the hijackers, Nawaf al-Hazmi and Khalid al-Midar. These were men who were sort of the advance guard of the 9/11 hijackings, and they met with a man named Omar al-Bayoumi, who is kind of a very central character in all of this. He serves as essentially a conduit for the al-Qaeda extremists and the Saudi government. Now, the CIA, for example, knew that those two hijackers had met in Kuala Lumpur with Sheikh Khalid Mohammed to plan something. This information, for whatever reason, did not make its way from the CIA to the FBI. They, in fact, allowed the hijackers to enter the country to meet almost immediately with Bayoumi. And, of course, we all know what happened. The FBI, in fact, at the time, chose not to act on that information. They said no action required in internal documentation. So we know at the very CIA, the FBI, not on the same page there. And from in terms of what this document tells us that is new, again, not a lot. So I wouldn't imagine that the families of the victims are terribly thrilled if this is any indication of the kind of declassification that we can go that we can expect going forward. Not a whole lot here.
Right. All right. Well, thanks so much for that update. And of the D.C. Press News correspondent, Wyatt Reed. Now, I'd like to welcome my other guests to this spotlight. Dan Kovalik, international human rights lawyer out of Pittsburgh. And John Bosnich, journalist and political analyst out of Zurich.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Thank you both for being with us. Let me start this off with John in Zurich. Right after the attacks, there was already suspicion of Saudi involvement, especially because the majority of hijackers were Saudi. Why do you think that the possible Saudi involvement wasn't really pursued?
Well, this is a pretty obvious, piece of information. The Bush family had a very close relationship with the Saudi government, and the U.S. intelligence services already had a very close relationship with the Saudi activists who were being sent into battle in Afghanistan and who were being used in all around the world already by the CIA. So anything that touched upon the Saudi links to Washington would have been taboo and would have been quashed immediately.
What does that mean, John, staying with you? I mean, because of the involvement that Washington had with certain Saudi entities, but would the government would be willing to ignore if the Saudi government was actually involved in this terrorist attack?
Well, the entire topic of 9/11 is itself a Pandora's box. We have, you know, I studied engineering. I spent years in engineering before going into journalism, and I can tell you that the entire engineering about the ability of two airplanes by themselves to bring down two buildings is always in question, and there are thousands of engineers in America who have signed petitions saying that it was not possible and that it had to have been an inside job. But that's a topic in itself. What we do know is that the CIA was arming and financing terror units from the Saudi regime, and they were sending them around the world wherever they needed them, and they wanted to use them against the Soviet Union. So this was a super sensitive subject. In fact, when I was working in Washington 8 years later, it was still a taboo topic, mm-hmm. Which could only be addressed on very, very tender terms.
Okay, I'm going to get back to that Pandora's box that you talked about, John, but let me get Dan in on this discussion. Dan, if we look at some of these documents that have been reluctantly released and still heavily redacted, what exactly does that mean? On the one hand, to release information, but really not to release the information. And then this 20 years later, what do you think this is all about?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, first of all, there is a lawsuit that some of the families of the 9/11 victims have brought against Saudi Arabia. And so I think the government feels some obligation to release information about any Saudi involvement with the 9/11 attacks. But as you say, not enough to really clarify what happened. I mean, the great shame, of course, of all this is that, you know, most of the attackers were from Saudi Arabia. Clearly, Saudi Arabia had some involvement and supported this terrorist attack in some way, certainly ideologically, if in no other way. And how did the U.S. respond to this? It attacked countries that not only had nothing to do with 9/11, but that were actually opposed to Al-Qaeda and groups like that. And so it attacked Saddam Hussein's Iraq, and it attacked Libya and Syria, and has tried to undermine Iran, which actually helped the U.S. after 9/11 fight Al-Qaeda. And so obviously, the U.S. government knows all this and knows that what the U.S. did in response to 9/11 has absolutely no justification, never had any justification. And so they've waited as long as possible to release documents, and I have a feeling we'll never know the full truth of what happened on 9/11, but we know enough. Again, we know that the perpetrators were not the countries that have been attacked. And truthfully, that should be enough to mm-hmm. know that this thing has been mishandled in a hugely criminal way.
Well, John, you talked about that Pandora's box earlier. Now Dan said what we do know is that the countries that were attacked were not involved. We know no Afghani was on the was a hijacker, nor Iraqi. But these two countries were immediately, especially Afghanistan, of course, right away, it was invaded, and then Iraq. So what does this mean? Was this whole thing planned, and planned by whom, to actually be able to start this war on terror? I mean, where do we start here? We go with the chicken or the egg. I mean, you go. Go ahead, John. Let me hear what you have to say about this.
I can tell you that we do have factual evidence that the United States has had a hit list since the late 1970s of countries and governments around the world that they wanted to remove. However, given the fact that there is modern media and there is a reporting base that can report what the U.S. government is up to, there had to be a really big excuse to make war on these countries. You can't just do what they used to do hundreds of years ago, just declare war on a country for the interests of your nation. So there had to be a trigger. And this event, the 9/11 attack, was too convenient for anybody who works in the field in which I've been working. I've worked as a war reporter, I have experience in engineering and structural engineering, and I've worked as a government advisor. And I can tell you that this particular incident matches the criteria exactly for what was planned, and that was knockout strikes against several, in one case they said it was up to seven countries that were going to be knocked out and have their governments replaced by pro-American regimes. And we know that the events at 9/11 were quickly followed up with these kinds of wars. So I would suggest that there's still if I had to say my opinion about 9/11, my opinion is that the event was staged with the knowledge of the US government and with the participation of the Saudi government, which benefited from the wars that have been made against Saudi enemies or threatening nations near to the Saudi kingdom.
Okay. Well, you just mentioned the word benefited, John, and let me get Dan in on this, because it, like with any crime situation, the first thing one asks is, who benefited? Which country benefited from the situation that happened on 9/11 and, of course, the war on terror following it? What would you say? How would you answer that question, Dan?
Yes, I mean, first of all, I think the primary group that benefited was not any particular nation, but it was defense contractors. I mean, they made out like gangsters, literally, like gangsters. You know, getting trillions of dollars from U.S. taxpayers for wars that have gone on now for 20 years and that will continue to go on in one form or another, because, of course, every war brought upon the region more conflict, right? Libya was really the classic case. You know, that has destabilized all of northern Africa. The Iraq war destabilized that part of the world. The intervention in Syria has destabilized not only Syria, but Lebanon. And so that sort of instability, it's hard for me to say that any particular country benefited very much at all, because every country has reaped a certain whirlwind from these terrible events. But again, the defense industry, they've done wonderfully, and they are happy, and their shareholders are happy. And that's really who benefited. I just want to add one thing. You know, it's clear that, you know, as was said, that the U.S. was planning to go after some of these countries, including Afghanistan, even before the 9/11 attacks. It's also clear that, for example, the CIA and George Tenet, head of the CIA at the time, knew that something like this was going to happen, did not tell the FBI, did not tell other parts of the government that could have stopped it. They wanted a Pearl Harbor. That's not to say, you know, that I side with those who think that the U.S. government actually created that Pearl Harbor, but I think there's some good evidence that there were actors who allowed it to go forward and happen as a justification for these wars, which again have benefited the military-industrial complex.
Well, John, let me open that Pandora's box a little bit more now. I want to talk about the possibility, because we're looking at which entities could have benefited. Now, Dan talked about the wars that have taken place and the destabilization, for example, talking about Syria and Lebanon. With that being said, there are some actual analysts who say that they feel that actually Israel was one of the biggest beneficiaries in 9/11. Your take on that?
Absolutely. I want to underline that I agree with your other guest when he said it may not be the country that benefits. And in fact, definitely the country of America did not benefit by going to war all over the world. So And this is a standard mistake that people think. People think around the world that when America goes to war, it's because the interests of America are at stake. That's not the case. If you review the recent wars that America has been involved with, these are wars which serve the military-industrial complex first. And these are beyond windfall profits. These are unlimited amounts of money flowing from the taxpayer to the military-industrial complex. And I want to tie these things together. The fact that there was a hit list meant that there needed to be a spark to start the militarism, to start the wars off. But then there was also the added component of the fake color revolutions, which were used to launch regime change in other countries. So it was a two-fist approach. We will respond to the evil countries who attacked us, which were not the countries in any way involved in the attack. And at the same time, other countries were being destabilized and big riots were being coordinated by the CIA. So this full court push by the CIA, and it came after a 15-year period in which the target country was publicly listed and publicly known. So there is here for the tower bombings to have been a single unrelated event. The softest thing I can say is that perhaps, I doubt it, but perhaps the CIA found out that this group of Saudis was going to make the attack, and once they found out about it, they did not inform the government. They allowed the attack to go forward. They made sure it took place and then used it as a disaster on which they could justify making war. The other extreme is that the government was involved, not at the peak. Normally, the secret deep state operates around the president without informing the president so the president can maintain deniability. There have been several academic research papers done about Pearl Harbor, about the Gulf of Tonkin, and definitely 9/11 has to be added to the list of events that most likely were known of or rigged and used as an excuse by the U.S. military-industrial complex to make wars and to take money basically directly from the U.S. taxpayers' pocket. And you asked me about Israel. There is no greater lobby in Washington than the Israel lobby. A man named John Mearsheimer wrote an excellent book on the topic called The Israel Lobby. And if any one country benefited as a country from the aftermath of 9/11, it was Israel. Because as soon as 9/11 was staged or conducted by whichever group conspired to do it, Israel was the first country to say, see, this is what we're up against. Now you have to join us in our wars. And America did. Thousands of Americans died. Hundreds of thousands, if not millions of others died. And trillions of dollars were sunk into the military-industrial complex. That's the entire scenario.
Well, Dan, where does it leave the United States right now? As John said, obviously, the American people did not benefit from 9/11. And if we look at where it started, of course, in Afghanistan, and 20 years later, of course, the Taliban is back in control in Afghanistan. And so all of this money, all the excuse that they use in their war on terror, basically, they haven't gotten a lot. But again, are we just going to talk about the U.S. government and the American people? Or was all of this done for the military-industrial complex?
Well, I think it largely was done for that. I mean, I do think that there was a grander strategy of trying to remake the Middle East, West Asia, and you know, parts of Northern Africa, to remake them into places that were seen as more hospitable to U.S. economic interest and to Israeli expansion. I think that was part of the goal, but in the end, I don't think that largely succeeded. I think the U.S. probably has now lost the Middle East forever, has no credibility in that part of the world or much of the part of the world. Most people in the world understand that what the U.S. did after 9/11 was a crime, and it was worse, much worse than the crime they were responding to. And I think in the end, certainly the American people have suffered greatly, not from to an extent from 9/11, of course. There was a huge death toll from that. But the American people have suffered much greater from the U.S. reaction to it. Again, the trillions of dollars that went into this war have not benefited the American people. The U.S. infrastructure is in decline. It's ruined in large part. We see this, you know, with how these floods are being handled in places like New York City, which should have been, redesigning its infrastructure years ago in anticipation of this. We see this in the COVID numbers, which are still the worst in the world. The U.S. is basically a third world country now. And the 9/11 wars helped bring that about. And
okay,
again,
I'm out of town, Dan. I'm out of time, Dan. But, John, is this the end to the American empire?
Well, it is the biggest step in that direction. And the fact is that with so much of that report still blocked out, if the truth were ever released to the American public, it would be the American public that would pull down their own empire from the inside.
Okay, and on that note, so sorry, we are out of time. Appreciate both of you being with us out of Pittsburgh. Dan Kovalik, international human rights lawyer, and out of Zurich, journalist and political analyst, John Busnich. And we appreciate you being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Goodbye.
With you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
At least 1,500 Palestinian residents in Silwana Lots are at risk of ethnic cleansing in favor of a Jewish tourist park to be established on the site of their historic neighborhood. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Jessica Boxbaum Ryder. This article is published under the heading American Tax Dollars Financing Israeli Regime Tourist Park Atop Historic Palestinian Neighborhood. Stay tuned for more. Roughly 2.5 miles from Sheikh Jarrah, the Palestinian neighborhood that grabbed the world's attention in May, lies Silwan. This neighborhood in occupied East Al-Quds is perched atop the steepest slopes just outside the old city. Houses are tightly compacted and stacked on top of each other as they dip into the valley below. And here, Palestinian residents face the same fate as their brethren in Sheikh Jarrah. The Zionist regime forces raided the Al-Busta neighborhood in Silwan with bulldozers on June 29th, razing a butcher shop and dispersing Palestinian protesters defending their homes with tear gas, stun grenades, batons, and rubber-coated steel bullets. At least 13 people were injured and 6 arrested, including the owner of the butcher shop, Nidal Al-Rajabi, and his sons and brothers. In regard to the recent demolition, Norwegian Refugee Council's Palestine County Director Caroline Ord said in a press release, under the 4th Geneva Convention, Israel has an obligation to protect civilians under its occupation and to refrain from destroying private property. Al-Rajabi's store was destroyed on the pretext of lacking a building permit.
Various human rights organizations involved in the issue state conflicting numbers, but according to Fakhri Abu Diab, spokesman for SEAL 1, 16 buildings in Al-Bustan are also at immediate risk of being torn down. About 1,500 Palestinians live in more than 100 houses in Al-Bustan. On June 7th, two structures, including the butcher shop, received notices from the municipality of Al-Quds to self-demolish their homes within 21 days, or municipality authorities would do so and charge the residents the demolition fees, calculated about $6,000. Amy Cohen, Director of International Relations and Advocacy at Ir Amim, Al-Quds nonprofit, told Min Press News the second structure, a residential unit, has yet to receive a visit from municipality inspectors. According to Ir Amim, 68 homes in Al-Bustan have pending demolition orders so as to execute the Al-Quds municipality's King Garden plan. The municipality outlined the initiative in 2010, stating, "The King's Garden area, Al-Bustan in Arabic, will be developed into a tourist and residential district. Commercial sections, restaurants, and art galleries will be built, turning it into a bustling tourist zone. For the first time, the local residents will have the legitimate right to live in this neighborhood." The development plan has not moved forward since 2010, but the municipality's recent objection to extending the demolition freeze suggests the plan could be reactivated. In February, the Al-Quds municipality filed an objection in the local affairs court against Al-Bustan's residents' request to extend the demolition freeze, arguing the proposed zoning plan for the area doesn't follow proper guidelines and isn't advancing quick enough. In March, the court ruled to extend the demolition freeze until August 15th. Negotiations have been ongoing between the municipality and the residents to develop a suitable zoning plan for Al-Bustan since 2005. In 2009, the residence plan was rejected by the municipality in favor of the King's Garden plan. According to Murad Abu Shafi, an Al-Bustan resident who received the demolition order, the municipality told the residents, "This structure plan can't happen in Israel. This might happen in Europe or any Arab country, but not here. Our plan was very modern, and it doesn't fit with the Israeli regime's standards for East Al-Quds," Abu Shafi explained. "The Zionist regime doesn't want us to have a modern neighborhood. They want us always to be below the line." Despite the local court's ruled extension, 20 demolition cases, including the butcher's shop order, were excluded from the freeze due to the Zionist regime Kamenetz law, known as Amendment 116 to Planning and Building Law, which was fully enacted in 2019. This legislation intensifies enforcement against unauthorized construction and allows for little legal intervention in preventing demolitions of structures built after 2017. The amendment has been partially frozen since 2020 amid ongoing discussions with Palestinian parliamentary members in the Israeli regime. In a statement to Min Press News, the Al-Quds municipality said there is no intention to build a biblical garden in the area. "This is a false claim. The area is designated for gardens and parks for the benefit of local residents of SEAL 1. The vast majority of demolition orders in Al-Bustan are suspended. There are a few demolition orders that the court has recently decided to unfreeze. It should be emphasized that these orders are old and no new orders were issued whatsoever. As to the execution of these orders, the municipality is obliged to act in accordance with the law and with the court rulings. We are still studying the latest ruling profoundly and will decide on our next steps according to the situation on the ground." The municipality noted that Al-Bustan is designated as a green area because of its location near the Kidron River. Jeff Halper, director of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions, explained that
When Israel annexed East Alot in 1967 following the Six-Day War, it declared the entirety of East Alot as open green space, meaning the area is frozen for future building. Halper pointed out the hypocrisy of this development policy in how Israel treats settlement building versus Palestinian building, explaining, "Today, more than 100,000 Israelis live in East Alot in these big settlements. But if East Alot was frozen 100% for building, then how did you get all that building for Israelis? The answer is, Israel rezones for Jewish settlements. But when a Palestinian wants to build, Israel says, sorry, this area isn't zoned for residential development, but for open green space. So it's really the use of bureaucracy and law and planning as tools of control. Construction in Al-Bustan was done primarily by Palestinian residents themselves on their own land, but often without the necessary building permits. Er Amims Cohen explained this is mostly owing to a lack of viable zoning plans rather than the municipality's flat-out rejection of building permits. With the absence of an outline plan, residents are precluded from acquiring the permits. You either have a lack of a zoning plan or you have such outdated zoning plans, which are from, say, 30 to 40 years ago, that it's impossible to then receive building permits, and this is a very acute way that the Israeli regime authorities have neglected their municipal responsibility to provide this service. Cohen concluded since 1967, this has been a means to suppress Palestinian building and planning within Palestinian areas. Silvan is located in Holy Basin, an area coveted by religious settlers for its proximity to the Old City and alleged connections to King David. Er David or Ilat settler organization runs the City of David National Park in Al-Bustan area since 1990s. Ilat has sought to transform Silvan into a symbol of Jewish biblical past. Al-Bustan is specifically targeted because it stands as an obstacle to achieving Er David's vision of a biblical paradise. Ilat's actions aren't focused solely on building settlements, but also on promoting archaeological excavations, tourist attractions, and parks. According to the Foundation for West Asia Region Peace Process report on Al-Bustan, the settlers' goals became the official policy of the Israeli regimes in 2005, when then Prime Minister Ariel Sharon's regime approved plans to develop the Holy Basin area. In essence, the DNA of Ilat's biblical ideology became the DNA of the Israeli regime in and around the Old City, with the regime outsourcing many of its authorities to Ilat in order to pursue these objectives. FMEP wrote in its report, the lines between the regime and the settlers became so blurred that they almost disappeared. Odeh, whose family faces displacement in Al-Bustan and in Al-Batan Al-Hawa, another neighborhood in Silvan and settler target, described the deep interconnections between settlers and the Zionist regime, citing as an example that Ari King is Al-Quds deputy mayor, but is also a notorious settler leader responsible for displacing Sheikh Jarrah residents. These settler organizations are the people running the regime, Odeh said. They receive full support from the military and any ministry and municipality. Er David isn't just supported by the Israeli regime, but also backed by American money. Er David's sister nonprofit in the U.S., Friends of Er David, secures tax-exempt donations for the organization. According to a January investigation by Mint Press News, Hertog Foundation, Irving I, Moskowitz Foundation, Adelson Family Foundation, Mindel Foundation, Samueli Foundation, Jay and Jeannie Scottstein Foundation, and Jewish Communal Fund have all donated to Friends of Er David. The organization's biggest contributors are the Irving Moskowitz and Adelson Family Foundations. In 2018, the Irving Moskowitz Foundation gave Friends of Er David $1.5 million, and the Adelson Family Foundation contributed about $3 million. Dear David Foundation did not respond to a request for comment.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.